Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining editor Simon Lambert and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, poorly understood, counterintuitive, simply unclear. What should we do about inheritance tax? The body tasked with shaking up our most hated tax has come up with a few ideas. Do they go far enough, though? And what about if Labour come into power? Also today, Deutsche sends shockwaves through the city, E.ON goes green, whether you like it or not, and Mini goes electric. But does Simon like it or not? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. Now, it takes some doing to be considered the most hated of all taxes, especially when so few people actually pay it. But there you go, inheritance tax, the most hated, it's official. According to the Office of Tax Simplification, it's been working out at the request of the Chancellor. What on earth can be done about it? Now, we told you all about this back in November. Well, we now have an update with the OTS giving some of their suggestions. Will the Chancellor take heed? And what about the small issue of a Labour government perhaps waiting in the wings with some of their own plans for the tax? But first, a very warm welcome. Simon, very briefly, recap of what the Chancellor has asked the Office of Tax Simplification to look at specifically. Now, it was pretty damning in their initial report. Also worth noting, not in its remit to affect policy. So it can't actually get rid of inheritance tax.
No, but these are the government's tax gurus. These are the people charged with...
That sounds so much nicer than the Office of Tax...
Yeah, it is, gurus. Isn't it? Tax I think there gurus. Might actually be a company called the Tax Gurus, so even if they'd wanted to call them the Tax Gurus, they couldn't have done. Presumably there is not a company called the Government's Tax Gurus. It's probably a scam company. If you ever get contacted by a company claiming to be the Government's Tax Gurus, don't do anything with them. Warning there. They were asked to take a look at inheritance tax. Now, to many people, the great hope would have been that this would mean inheritance tax was charged at a lesser rate. Because even though only 5% of estates pay it, it is, as the Office of Tax Simplification commented, uniquely unpopular. Yeah. And as you pointed out, it says something for a tax to be uniquely unpopular.
But you pointed out last time that even though 5% pay it, 10 times that have to fill out all the complicated forms. And please do listen to podcast back about Simon's... It was a saga, wasn't it?
Oh, it is a saga. And there is that was one of the things that was flagged by the Office of Tax Simplification in their first report on this, which was looking at the administration of it and how many, many more estates have to fill in the forms, even though it's going to be obvious at the end of it that they don't owe any tax. For example, I had to deal with this when my dad died and we did probate. He left everything to my mum. There just was no inheritance tax to pay. Quite why there wasn't a box that you ticked that said that, because ultimately it doesn't really matter what his assets are worth. It matters what they're worth when the surviving partner then passes away. So that's one of the problems that I've identified. But in this one, the Office of Tax Simplification looked at all of the complicated rules around giving away different sums of money and things like that. So there's three main issues with inheritance tax. One, it's uniquely unpopular. Two, lots and lots of people have to fill in the forms for it, even though they know they won't end up paying it. And three, there's this complicated system of reliefs. And that's what the Office of Tax Simplification was looking at this point. Now, it is worth mentioning in the not many people pay it thing that whilst only 5% of estates pay it at the moment, that is projected to rise substantially. And also the 5% of estates includes first deaths. So it might be that whilst the first person in a couple didn't incur it because they left it everything to their spouse, and because couples can double up their allowance, that actually the second person in a couple will. So that 5% is probably a little bit misleading. And also, as the generation that has profited substantially from house price growth or suffered substantially from house price growth, depending on how you see it, ultimately dies off, then many, many more people will get sucked in, even though we've got this new own home allowance that means a married couple or civil partners can effectively give away £1 million. But underlying all that, there is the fact that the easiest way to dodge inheritance tax is to give your money away. But there are rules about that so that people can't just give everything away on their deathbed and avoid paying the tax. And the rules are complicated. Would you like to hear some of them?
I do, but I just wanted to tell you a comment that I was reading in an other publication that said that the problem with inheritance tax is it's basically voluntary. Because those people who can afford to will have all the great accountancy that will make it so that they don't have to pay it. Is that one of the issues with it?
Well, one of the criticisms that was raised in the first Office of Tax Simplification report is that the effective rate of inheritance tax paid by estates. So you've got to bear in mind that although inheritance tax is levied at 40%, it's only above the thresholds that you get, which are quite generous. So the effective tax rate is less than 40%. But as you go up, it climbs as you start to get into the people who leave estates worth £1 million or more. And then you get up into the sort of mid millions. And then it starts to decline again. And you notice that actually the very rich pay a lower percentage in inheritance tax than the wealthy, you know, upper middle class who are being sucked into it largely in southern England due to property inflation. And that doesn't seem particularly fair, considering the fact that inheritance tax was actually designed as a tax for the very rich, not for the wealthy middle class. But as with many of our taxes that sort of levy themselves on people's property wealth, governments became increasingly dependent and keen on these as they allowed house price inflation to run out of control. And house price inflation is a double-edged sword because, yes, you could argue that people have got unearned wealth, but also you could argue that those people who, with that unearned wealth, paid, you know, higher house prices, were less able to move, have paid the higher cost of living in the south of England, the train fares, the extra taxes, the higher council tax. They've got the children who can't afford to buy in their own home area and all those other things. And it's much more complicated than just saying, well, your house has gone up loads in value, you didn't earn it. And one of the main reasons why people hate inheritance tax, even though lots of people don't pay it, is because they see it as double taxation. So they see it as tax on money that they have saved in their lifetime or assets they've built up in their lifetime from earnings that were already taxed. And also there's the 40% thing, which is nearly half. And nobody likes the idea of the government taking nearly half of their lifetime
true.
Wealth. But there's all these, you can get away with just giving your money away. But you can't just do it on your deathbed. So there's a thing called the 7-year rule. And the 7-year rule says that you have to survive for 7 years after you've given away money or assets. And if you do, at the end of that, it should be tax-free. It's a little bit more complicated than that. That there are also limits on how much you can give away each year. So, for example, you can give away up to £3,000. You can give away small gifts. You can give away some money if your children get married. You can give away money out of excess income, which is a super, super grey area that no one really seems to understand and what counts as excess income.
Yeah.
And exactly how you keep tabs on this. But a lot of these exemptions and these amounts of money that you could give were set, as the Office of Tax Simplification commented in its report, in the 1980s. Weddings have got a bit more expensive than they were.
Small gifts of 250
yeah,
quid.
Yeah, exactly. Small gifts. I mean, you literally, if you gave your child £3,000 to help them buy a car, that's it. You're done for the year. £3,000, it's a lot of money, but it doesn't go that far nowadays. It needs an overhaul. And what the Office of Tax Simplification has said is that all of these little exemptions and reliefs and allowances should just be axed. They should be rolled into one annual allowance that you can just give away that amount of money. And that should be higher and should reflect inflation, the modern day cost of living and things like that. But it's also said that the 7-year rule should be changed and it should be cut to 5, at which point those people who don't like inheritance tax, of which there are many, would go woohoo. But there was a warning that came with that, in that they wanted to axe this taper that's involved. So if you die within those 7 years, you pay a progressively lower, there's a progressively lower rate of tax levied on your estate. We often speak about it as you pay a lower rate of tax. You, of course, will not pay any tax because you will be dead. Death and taxes, two certainties, but once you're dead, they can't actually tax you. They can tax your estate, though. You pay a progressively lower rate. If they remove the taper and people die within those 7 years, then you could find that people effectively pay more tax. And there's a couple of other little things in there, including one particular trick involving capital gains tax.
You're going to tell us what that is, or are we just going to guess?
No, it was like a cliffhanger. So There's two reliefs that are used, and this is really, really complicated in here. And the Office of Tax Simplification did a good job with this report, but they did not simplify this bit.
Mm-hmm.
Agricultural property relief and business property relief. This involves leaving business assets or agricultural assets, farmland and things like that, has to be actually used agriculturally. And if you do this, then you can get an exemption from inheritance tax upon that. And you can give it away. And then the way the system works is that in terms of capital gains tax, when someone dies and they leave their assets in their estate, when the assets in that estate are passed on to the heirs, either the executors sell all of them and then just hand over the money, or they might hand over the assets. So, for example, your grandparent might die and leave a house to you and your siblings, and you decide that you're going to keep ownership of that house. Now, if you then sell that house in the future, for the purposes of capital gains tax, you have to pay because it's your second home. But the value is reset at the point when you inherited it. So the market value at the date of death. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a benefit hugely to people who are left agricultural and business property, who then sell it, or, you know, shares, who then sell them down the line, because they get this kind of double benefit of inheritance tax free plus also being reset for capital gains. The Office of Tax Simplification has said this is an issue. So they've said that it should be looked at that when an asset is inherited and then held onto and then sold at a later date, for capital gains tax purposes, the original value of what is bought for is used. But they only talked about this in terms of agricultural property and business property relief. They didn't talk about it in the context of what many people will have happen, where, for example, they're left a home by a parent or a grandparent. Now, if your parent or your grandparent left you a property and you held onto it for a couple of years and you rented it out perhaps, and then you decided to sell it, and the market value at death, instead of that being used, the value they bought the property being used for, you would face an absolutely colossal potential capital gains tax bill, because they might have bought that house in the 80s for £20,000 and it might now be worth £300,000, for example. And it wasn't clear, the Office of Tax Simplification didn't define between these two things. So there is a potential sting in the tail. But we spoke to an expert about this, Tanya, when she wrote about this on Friday, spoke to a tax expert about this, who said, you know, these are just the recommendations. Obviously, the OTS can't actually decide on policy. And were something like this to come up, there's going to be a lot of people who'd flag this issue. And it's very unlikely that something wouldn't be done about it. But just as an aside, one of the interesting things about agricultural property relief and business property relief is, especially agricultural property relief, this is a major loophole that very, very rich people use to jump through. There are very, very rich people buying up farmland around the country that they then contract out to someone to farm, and then they can pass it on to their heirs inheritance tax free. They can pass on vast fortunes of millions or tens of millions of pounds. It's happening all over the country, and it causes a real problem for anybody who wants to get into farming and doesn't have a farm to inherit or a lot of money behind them, because they can't afford to buy land to actually farm, because it's all being bought by rich folk dodging inheritance tax.
So there we go, Lee. Lots of stuff to chew over there. You have been speaking to the experts, but look, by and large, an overview of what's been suggested, whether it's going to come in or not, because like we said, it is just a suggestion, does it go some way into simplifying what is a very complex and not very popular tax?
I'm not sure it does. I'm sure there's a simpler way of doing all this, Georgie. It's one of those taxes that's just so complicated for people. And if you ever get sort of hooked into the net, it's very hard to sort of decipher what is actually going on. Now, you know, the Treasury's taking in £5.7 billion a year at the moment. It's going to grow to £6.9 billion within 5 years. That's quite a substantial bit of growth there. So more and more people are going to get into the net of this. And as Simon just rightly said there, it feels to me like it's becoming progressively more a tax on the middle classes than it is on, you know, the real sort of elite people that are holding millions and millions of pounds. And there's ways in which they're dodging the system. And I find this, there's a couple of problems I have with inheritance tax. And one of them is, you know, people have their property I think fundamentally in this country, we just always focus on property price and, you know, how property prices have grown. That's not the fault of someone that's bought a property and lived in it for decades and then wants to pass it on to their children. You know, that's just a fact of life. I'd want to pass my house on to my child. Why do I have to, you know, why are we all penalised so much for whereabouts we live? I just think it's a bit of a bodge system. And the other problem, and I've been a vocal critic of this over the years on this podcast, I just think it's a tax on being successful. You know, what's wrong with, you know, if you or I, George, become a millionaire from our talents, okay, it's probably not going to happen. But if we did, and then I've worked hard all my life to provide for my children, why wouldn't I be able to pass it on without a huge tax hit when I've already paid tax my entire life at a high rate?
I'm going to throw something at you, just not
throw
that
it
I believe
me.
It, but it's like, well, you might be lucky enough to work in an industry in where that is valued. That doesn't mean if you work, say, as a nurse and you've worked incredibly hard compared to, say, a footballer, for example, and I hate picking on them because it's just so easy. But you know what I mean? It's like you are working hard in an industry where that is at the moment deemed to be rewarded.
Yeah, no, I get your point on that, Georgie. But
that's not my point.
I would make a point, and that is why we have an income tax, that it goes progressively higher for the more income that you earn. That's the problem, is the double taxation argument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's exactly my point. And I just think, like, What I do have a problem with is this kind of like generational wealth. You know, it's been passed down from generation, from earls, you know, from the 12th century and all that sort of stuff. Do you know what I mean? And all the land that people hold, that kind of thing. For me, it should be targeted. But when you're starting to hook in people that are earning, you know, six-figure salaries because of their talents, they might not necessarily have parents that were rich that have managed to open doors for them. Maybe they have worked hard from the beginning to get where they're at and they're earning, like, you know, a decent salary. What are we just penalise? Are we just going to consistently penalise people for that? You know, this kind of thing. Now, I'll go back to the point of, you know, 5% of people get hooked into this, and then it's probably even smaller than that, really, in reality. But it's going to become a growing problem in the coming years. Now, the Office of Tax Simplification, a classic name for a department which sometimes you just think, wow, are we actually living in 1984? They could just strip this whole thing back and make some changes in which it makes it a fairer system for all. I think Simon's argument of a 20% flat rate is a good one. Mm-hmm. I think that just instantly people can sort of actually realise what that means for them, rather than all of these different hoops and loops and things that you can like dodge and jump through.
But people will still find a way. There'll always be a way.
There will always be a way, Georgie. There will. But...
but shouldn't we then target rather than simplify this and do that? Shouldn't we just target and make sure that those ultra wealthy people are paying more?
Yeah,
that's what Labour would argue.
I think there is an argument for that, and I think there's also an argument for when we've got, you know, big businesses that are in this country and not paying what I would deem their fair share of tax for being in this country. We should be going after more of that type of thing rather than just aspirational middle class people that, you know, are the bread and butter of this country that are just trying to work hard and want to pass on their wealth to their children. I don't. Why is that such a problem? And we're getting double taxed for that. It's one of those things, and I think that's how a lot of people feel, and I think that's why it's such a deeply unpopular tax.
We've all said that this was traditionally seen as a tax on wealth, on the wealthy, and so politically speaking, you'd think, you know, it's got Labour written all over it as something to target wealthier people. But with more and more, as Lee said, middle-income people being drawn into it, they're sort of losing the political war on this one.
Well, if you think inheritance tax is unpopular, you just wait until Labour try to bring in their idea. Basically, we've got the Office of Tax Simplification on one side saying this, and the Tories who committed to raise the inheritance tax threshold to £1 million and sort of bodged it George Osborne style with this own home allowance, which the OTS didn't go quite so far as saying should be scrapped. They said it's only just come in, we should really monitor how it's going. I think the sensible thing would have been to just, like, if you want to make it £1 million, just make it £1 million. Don't bring in this own home allowance that distorts the system further. But Labour would prefer to bring in something called a lifetime gift tax. Now, this was something that was flagged in a report called Land for the Many that was commissioned by the Labour Party and looked largely at the property market and things like that. And in it, it lent support to an idea that has been floated by a number of left-wing think tanks, including the IPPR, the Institute for Public Policy Research, very closely linked to the Labour Party, and the Resolution Foundation, another think tank, of which, instead of you being able to give away a certain amount of money tax-free, you should be able to receive a certain amount of money tax-free, above which you would pay income tax levels of tax. And the amount that you could get tax-free that's been put forward is £125,000 through your lifetime. Now, if you consider the average couple with two children, and most people, obviously there's nothing to force them to leave their money just to their children, but most people end up leaving inheritance to their children. So the average couple with two children could leave them up to £1 million tax-free if they own their own home at the moment. This would revert to the average couple's children being able to receive £250,000 tax-free. And that's quite a big cut. And this would apply to any money that you are given through your lifetime. So you would have to tot up the bit where your parent helped you out with £3,000 to buy a car at some point, or gave you some money for your wedding. And then once you get to the point where you then inherit something. Mm. Now, the argument for this is that this stops entrenched wealth. And that is a problem because it causes inequality. And the report, Land for the Many report, said the reforms to inheritance tax are designed to allow for the better sharing out of the unearned windfalls arising out of the housing boom. Of course, there is a slight problem with that statement, in that it's very possible that there are a large number of people in this country who have more than the £125,000 that they would like to leave to an individual child that hasn't come from the housing boom at all, that they saved it up from a lifetime of saving and investing and so on. And that won't be unearned. That will have come from their taxed income. There is also another problem in which you can envisage quite how difficult such a system would be to enforce. Because if it includes all of the money that you're ever given, how on earth is the government or the tax man going to keep tabs on that without there being a massive infringement upon your privacy? You know, for example, where do we draw the line? You know, if you get £50 in a birthday card, you know, some premium bonds bought for you as a child, is it the money that was given to you to help you buy a car? Is it, you know, you start university and your parents say, you're going to take out a student loan, you're going to pay for it yourself, but here you go, here's a grand, we're going to help you out. Or is it only when they start giving you larger sums of money? Because if the limit is as low as £125,000 per person for their entire lifetime, you're going to have to keep tabs on it whenever someone gets a grand or 500 quid. Also, you know, what lies behind this, the really important thing that what lies behind this is the potential for there to be a seismic shift in our tax system, because this is about trying to tax wealth. And this idea has been around for ages, you know, but there has been an increasing amount of support, particularly from the sort of left-wing think tanks, the kind of Corbynista, John McDonnell, you know, arm of the Labour Party, that we should have a wealth tax. It's not just enough to tax income in this country. We need to tax wealth. Taxing wealth is very difficult. There's a reason why lots of countries in the world don't have a wealth tax, and quite a few of them that have had it have got rid of it. It's because it doesn't really work very well. Mm. It's not because they're nice and they just want to give people lower taxes. It's because it's bloody hard to actually make people tot up their wealth all the time and to collect the money. And also the rich have this habit of annoyingly dodging it. Yeah. So in order to spread the tax base around enough to make it that you're collecting enough money, you have to then filter it down so it does get imposed on the wealthy middle classes, who then get really grumpy about a wealth tax. So despite the fact that it doesn't work, though, there is very strong chance that some form of increased taxation on wealth will come. And whether it's in your lifetime or on your death, which is easier to collect. On your lifetime, it's easier to collect if you levy it on people's houses. Again, very unpopular, but it's quite difficult to move your house or hide your house. There is going to be a tussle to come as years go on. And as with anything, our extremely fractured and polarised political landscape is going to heavily influence what goes on. There is going to be a major tussle between this, should you just tax income or should you more heavily tax wealth? And all of this goes back to your least favourite subject,
which, of course, is high house prices.
Yeah.
And as Lee said, I think I have a better idea for all of this. I think we should just completely take the sting out of inheritance tax by cutting the rate to 20%, because 20% is a palatable amount. It's not nearly half, which is what 40% is. And I think you'd then get more rich people going, well, you know what? I'm not that happy about handing over a fifth on my death, but it's not worth bothering dodging that. Whereas at 40%, it is worth bothering.
If you are in a situation now where you're thinking about inheritance, Lee, there is an article on your website with some of the 7 ways to protect your estate now. Just give us a couple if you would.
Yeah, definitely. Go and have a look at that article, because it's a very good read, and especially if it's something that's on the forefront of your mind. Some of the things that we've already spoken about, you've got the 7-year threshold. So one of the best things you can do really is to give away some of your wealth, you know, long before. And we don't know when we're going to die. But you can kind of know if you're starting to get into your 80s, for example, you know, your chances of surviving longer than 7 years starts to steadily decrease. So you might want to think about giving away some of your money. We've got the £3,000 gift. Now, that I think that should be raised. I mean, that was in the report. I mean, if it had gone up by inflation...
Is that per person or in total for the year?
Yeah, so that's per person.
Per beneficiary, I should have said.
That's the amount you can give away in a year. So divided between however many people you want.
So the beneficiaries...
So you could give 3,000 people a pound and you're done.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You can,
I'd recommend
if you like,
that.
But,
that'd be a quite interesting way to get rid of your wealth. But if it had gone in line with inflation,
for the many, not the few, Lee, it would have
quadrupled by now. But I would definitely have a look in that article. There's plenty of top advice in there. And that Labour plan that Simon was talking about, all I kept on thinking in my head was, that is one monster spreadsheet, Excel spreadsheet to keep, isn't it? Over decades.
I'm getting excited by that. Thought,
maybe
Lee,
you could keep it on the blockchain.
All right, well, we'll put those ideas to one side. We'll get a quick update, actually, if you don't mind, guys. Big news going on at Deutsche Bank. It's got almost 8,000 staff, so that makes it one of the biggest employers in the City of London. So this week we got some news that it was to cut 18,000 jobs as part of a radical reorganisation. Some have already been told about it. Obviously not all of those in London, because that maths doesn't work out. But in London, some staff didn't even bother coming in to the office on Monday morning because they got told that their passes would stop working at 11. Charming. So just, Simon, if you would, just briefly, what's going on? What will be the impact here in London?
Well, Deutsche Bank has been in trouble for many years, so it's no surprise that it's having to make cuts. It was a surprise quite how swinging those cuts were. Deutsche Bank made a big bet on breaking into the investment banking big league, so basically winning the Champions League kind of thing. In 1999, bought an American bank called Bankers Trust, did very, very well through the 2000s up until the financial crisis. Actually didn't suffer as badly as a lot of other of the big banks in the financial crisis, but then got caught out by the regulation afterwards designed to stop it happening again, which increased the amount of capital that banks had to hold and stopped them doing lots and lots of business with lots of debt. And also the appetite for the kind of risky trading stuff that Deutsche was doing waned. So it's really struggled to make money ever since. It's had to raise money from shareholders repeatedly. It's gone through a number of chief executives. It's gone through a number of plans to change things around. And now the boss who is there has come up with this final plan, which, if they manage to do it, should mean that the bank starts making a little bit more money, that shareholders become a little bit happier, that the share price stops falling, and that Deutsche Bank doesn't end up as a complete basket case. The key to all of this that has been commented on by banking analysts is that it's not a bad plan. It certainly could work, but it's the execution and whether Deutsche manages to do it. And by execution, we do not just mean culling people. We mean actually managing
staff.
To go through.
Give us in the context of the size of Deutsche.
90,000 people. So it's getting
this
rid of a big number of its workforce. Yeah.
But in terms of the impact, I guess, on the wider impact, Lee, on banking, on London, which of course has impact on the rest of the UK. What will that mean? What's going to be the knock-on effect, do you think?
Well, there were definitely sort of echoes of the financial crisis, weren't there, when we saw photographs of people with their pat boxes coming out of the building. And I think a lot of people see those kind of images and that's what they immediately associate back to Lehman Brothers and all that sort of thing. But it's a competitive world out there, Georgie, in the world of banking. These big banks, as Simon says, they make big bets. They made a big bet on this investment arm. It went swimmingly for 10 years. It's not gone so swimmingly since the financial crisis. The knock-on effect, At the moment, it's quite hard to tell whether there are other banks that are going to be, you know, clubbed in and having to do the same thing, the same sort of cuts. I think also it's quite interesting, there was a few comments around about this, about investment banking, and how basically a lot of people are also just losing their jobs from the improvement of things like algorithms.
Yeah.
And how, you know, these algorithms are outperforming humans. So it's kind of like, we've had all this argument in the past about a whole range of jobs are going to be, humans are going to be replaced by AI and by robots and whatnot. I don't think a lot of people necessarily associate banking with that kind of thing, but actually some of these algorithms are you know, basically taking people's jobs. So, you know, Deutsche Bank have had to make big cuts. You know, it's got offices around the world, and it's had to make difficult decisions to do this. Whether other banks are going to now be nervy and are going to have to start making the same cuts, well, it remains to be seen.
Indeed it does. All right, well, let's talk about E.ON, shall we? They are going green. The Big Six supplier announced it's introducing 100% renewable electricity in all of its customers' homes at no extra cost from this week. Now, it affects all 3.3 million residential customers across Britain, no matter what tariff they're on. E.ON says it's just reacting to us all becoming a bit more eco-aware. But, Lee, if you are on the market for a greener deal, there might be better options out there. So, firstly, E.ON, what is going on here?
Yeah, so E.ON have come out this week, and I think this is definitely a move that echoes sentiment around the country, really, as in people, I would say, in the last couple of years have been looking more so for green energy tariffs. Now, it's quite hard to get a pure 100% green energy overall tariff because it's hard to get 100% green gas. Mm. So we're talking here about electricity. For E.ON customers, it already has quite a big wind farm generating, so a lot of what will be supplied to customers already comes from their wind farms. And then it's got other ways in which it will tap in things like renewable electricity guarantee certificates, which basically mean you're being matched with green energy, right? So it's going to be interesting now to see if other big energy, so E.ON's one of the big six, mm-hmm. and whether any of the other companies now turn around and do it, and actually, if they can, you know, is there enough green energy electricity to go around to supply the whole country? I mean, strides have been made in the last decade, massively so, to, you know, supply Britain with greener electricity. Your mind is whirling at a million mile an hour.
I know, this is what's brilliant for podcasting, is you can't actually see my gurning face at the moment as I'm thinking about what impact this will have, especially in terms of the price of people's tariffs. Will it go up? Is it used to justify it going up? Suppliers in the past have blamed sort of the government's green initiatives on some of the reason why tariffs or the amount people are paying are so high anyway. I'm just wondering what's in it for them. That sounds so cynical.
No, but you're totally right, Georgie.
Do you know what I mean?
In it for them? Yeah, no.
How much of a bill's going to go up? Is this even possible? Is someone explain to me any of those issues? Allay my mind at rest.
So in theory, green energy is cheap, but there are the sunk costs that you have to put in order to generate it. So you've got to put up the windmills. Mm. I think they're actually called wind turbines.
You've got to
put in the technology. For example, if you want to harvest the energy from the waves, or you want to harvest solar. So there is the cost that you have to sink into it. But once you've done that, you know, the energy comes from nature. The energy, you are just harvesting the energy from nature.
Though?
So there is a... will we have enough of it? There are points when we produce about 60%, I believe, renewable energy into the grid. The difficulty is that obviously it's not reliable enough to be produced all the time. Sometimes the wind doesn't blow, sometimes the sun doesn't shine. People may have noticed that one. The great advantage of waves is that they do always keep moving, but that's a much harder way to do renewable energy. And so you need to have the backup of the coal-fired power stations, a bit of nuclear and everything, in order to keep the lights on, and that means that it can be expensive. So there are times when there's so much energy going into the grid that the government ends up paying people to not produce energy, because it's very difficult for us to store energy at the moment. Now, there are lots and lots of very, very clever people working on the kind of battery technology that will enable us to store energy and then put it back into the grid. There's even talk of, for example, electric cars being plugged in during the day. The energy is stored in the electric cars, and then the energy is sucked back out of the electric cars when it's needed. So if you take into account all of those things, then in theory, green energy should be cheaper. It isn't necessarily. what's interesting about E.ON is that it is generating a lot of this green energy rather than just buying these green energy certificates, which there's been some controversy about as to actually how much green energy is being used or produced, or whether you're just paying someone else to do something green.
Okay. I'm not knocking this, by the way. I just, you know. But Lee, practically speaking, are there better options out there? And when I say better options, I mean cheaper options.
Yeah, definitely. So in one hand, this is a very good move from E.ON. On the other hand, you should still have a look around to see if you can get a cheaper deal. And we've been given some cheaper offers from a comparison site, U-Switch, if you want a 100% green electricity tariff. So the cheapest one on the market, it says, is typically £873 per year, and that's from Outfox the Market. Now, that is a good few hundred pounds cheaper than a standard deal from E.ON. So definitely, you know, have a look around. There's some other smaller companies who've got People's Energy, So Energy, Yorkshire Energy, Octopus Energy, all offering tariffs, green tariffs, for under £1,000 per year. So if you are thinking about it, I would definitely have a look around, see what you can find in the green space. And it's an area that is growing substantially. Now, actually, someone in the office was saying they received a text from their supplier saying, would you like to switch to a green electricity tariff? Which I thought was quite interesting. They were prompted. It was up front and said it will cost you an extra 5% per year if you want to take it. I imagine quite a few people would go, do you know what? Yeah, I will do it. If it's better for the environment, 5%, maybe we will. And a lot of people wouldn't. But I think that's I think that's what we're going to see more of. You know, we've had this whole push towards smart meters. Maybe energy companies now are going to start a push towards people going green. But people will probably want to do that more, I would suggest, and get a smart meter.
All right, well, sticking with the green theme, finally, the first all-electric Mini has launched. The good news doesn't stop there, though. It's going to be built in Britain, exactly 60 years after its original predecessor revolutionised small car motoring and became an iconic symbol of an era. So the British car maker, owned by Germany's BMW, hopes the new battery-powered Mini can do the same. Simon.
Yes, the new battery-powered Mini. Yeah, well, maybe it can. I think this is probably going to be very popular. So it's going to sell for just under £25,000 once you take into account the £3,500 taxpayer-funded government subsidy. It's quite a lot more than a basic Mini 1, which starts at about £16,000. But it is actually slightly cheaper than what Mini are saying is the equivalent, a Mini Cooper S, which is the petrol-powered version. The range will be between 124 and 144 miles, as measured by the real-world new WLTP measure. So you're probably going to be closer to the 124 than 144 from my experience of driving electric cars, but you never know, Mini might surprise us. It could do 0 to 62 in 7.3 seconds, which isn't too bad. Goes on to a top speed that's electronically restricted to 93 miles an hour, which is quite low, although is 23 miles above the maximum speed limit. You know, make your own decisions on that one. But it's interesting. And where it fits in, for example, in terms of range versus and price against other cars, is you've got the Volkswagen E-Up, Yorkshire's favourite car. That is £24,625, similar price, but only got a range of 99 miles maximum. The Smart 4.2 EQ, that's only 16,500. The range on that is 99. The Renault Zoe, very popular, £21,000. Range of up to 186 miles quoted on that one. And then you start getting some more expensive cars. The Audi e-tron, for example, £68,000, 249 mile range. The Jaguar I-Pace, one of the best electric cars you can buy. Again, £61,000, range of 292 miles. And Tesla's Model 3, which the standard version, £38,000, has a range of 254 miles. This is a sign of things to come. More and more car makers are rolling out versions of their cars that are already popular that are now electric powered. So we're moving from a point where you either just had luxury, expensive Teslas and a bunch of noddy cars to a point where you've got normal cars being made electric. And yesterday, Bentley unveiled its vision of a car of 2035, which, unlike the Bentley Continental of today, which is powered by a 6-litre W12 engine, is all electric, and it says would have a range of 435 miles.
Although, bear in mind, this is concept car, so they can say anything they like.
I was going to say, it's 20,000
And it's also got these massive scissor doors that just like reach right up into the air. It looks stunning. Whether that's what a car looks like in 16 years' time, who knows? What I do know is you probably won't be able to afford it.
Touché.
So it's a Renault Zoe for you.
I was going to say 2035. I wonder if the inheritance tax laws have changed by then. I could perhaps get myself a Bentley.
Very good. All right, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you want to get in contact with us,
email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you've got a problem that you would like us to look into. You can tweet us at thisismoney if you just want to chat or comment on stuff, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the podcast past where you can argue to your heart's content about whether you should be able to give more money away tax-free when you die, or whether it is just entrenching privilege and wealth and people being able to buy electric Bentleys in 16 years' time.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you like this podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? Helps people find us.